Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us a bird's eye view of the Vatican Week. But first, Jill Bevilacqua brings us the next in her series of reflections on the Sunday Gospel by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
The apostles said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." And the Lord said, "If you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this sycamore tree, 'Be rooted up and be planted in the sea,' and it would obey you. Will any one of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he has come in from the field, 'Come at once and sit down at table'? Will he not rather say to him, 'Prepare supper for me, and gird yourself and serve me till I eat and drink, and afterward you shall eat and drink'? Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that is commanded you, say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty.'"
In the note to the first part of this gospel, we're told that this is a typical Eastern expression, which translated into our manner of speaking means that if we have a lively faith, even the working of miracles is not beyond us. And the note goes on, the lives of the apostles and saints is a confirmation of this. We're not told what the apostles' reaction was to our Lord's answer when they asked him to increase their faith, though we do know that later they did perform miracles. But the curious thing about this answer is the image our Lord uses. He was talking to illiterate fishermen, and just as when he talked to the crowds who were also illiterate, he used images of things they were familiar with, especially pastoral images, trees and fields, birds and seeds. Yes, seeds, but why the mustard seed? It's compared in a parable recounted by both Luke and Matthew to the kingdom of heaven.
"The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all the seeds, but when it has grown, it is the biggest shrub of all, and becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and shelter in its branches."
So there we have it. It's the smallest of all the seeds, but it grows big. And not only that, its leaves are so fast growing that it was said you could grow the salad for dinner while the meat was roasting. Mustard has been known since prehistoric times, and it's been used for many different purposes. In the 1st century AD, Pliny listed 40 remedies with mustard as the chief ingredient. It was the Romans who gave the herb its name, from mustos, the new wine they mixed with the seed, and ardens, for fiery. They served it with almost everything. Mustard seed can be black, white, or brown, but it's the black that has the strongest flavour. Probably the one that Shakespeare was thinking of in A Midsummer Night's Dream when he made Bottom the Weaver say to Mustard Seed the fairy, "I promise you, your kindred hath made my eyes water ere now." And that brings us to a sad episode in the history of mustard. For although it has many positive uses, an infusion of mustard seed is still recommended for colds and flu, and the Victorians were very fond of mustard baths, in the First World War, it was put to horrific use.
Gas. Gas. Quick, boys. An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time, but someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him, drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning.
And from soldier poet Wilfred Owen to voluntary nurse Vera Brittain, writing to her mother from France.
We have heaps of gassed cases at the present who came in a day or two ago. 10 in this ward alone. I wish those people who write so glibly about this being a holy war and the orators who talk so much about going on no matter how long the war lasts and what that may mean could see a case, not to say 10 cases, of mustard gas in its early stages, could see the poor things burnt and blistered all over with great mustard-coloured suppurating blisters with blind eyes, all sticky and stuck together and always fighting for breath, with voices a mere whisper saying that their throats are closing and they know they'll choke.
The victims of mustard gas suffered such intense pain that most of them had to be strapped to their beds, dying a slow and agonising death up to 5 weeks later. During the Great War, various types of gas were used, and by both sides, totalling 150,000 tonnes. A tragic far cry from the tranquil image of faith as a mustard seed. For the apostles and the crowds, Jesus then turned to a tree close by and challenged them to make an imaginative leap. With that tiny mustard seed-sized faith, he told them, you could say to this tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. What an idea. The tree, our Lord pointed out, was probably what we know as a mulberry. In the version we heard, it's called a sycamore, and here, when spelt sycomore, we're told it's a Middle Eastern fig tree, Ficus sycomorus. While from Middle English through Old French, we come to the Greek, sucomoros, from sukon, fig, and moron, mulberry. So take your choice. Incidentally, there are two morons in Greek. This is the one without the accent. The other is the neuter of moros, or foolish. Sycamore, I suppose, will always be synonymous with Zacchaeus, the taxman, who was so small he had to climb the tree so he could see Jesus as he passed by. And as children, of course, we all played with the seeds, pretending they were aeroplanes. As for the mulberry, it's always seemed to me a mythical sort of tree rather than a real one. Something to do with the old game where we all took hands and danced round in a ring. Certainly there were no mulberry bushes or trees in my childhood. But one fine day, not so very long ago, I came across the tree, a magnificent, majestic mulberry tree in an English garden. And on being invited to taste of its fruits, I did so and found them delicious. But it's hardly surprising that I was unfamiliar with the mulberry. It's not native to Britain or indeed Europe. Morus alba, the white mulberry, for there are two kinds, is a native of China, though it's now grown all over the world. Its berries, white, are enjoyed, we're told, by birds, animals, and people. It's widely planted for ornament, but probably it's best known for the silkworms which feed on its leaves and twigs. Yes, that makes sense. China. Silk. The black mulberry, Morus nigra, is a bit bigger than the white and comes from Asia Minor. Its fruit, when fermented, produces a light wine and, when distilled, an excellent grappa or brandy. It seems that the women of ancient Greece and Rome used its rich purple juice to bring colour to their cheeks. The mulberry has its fables, too. It's said that the fruit was originally white, but became blood red from the blood of Pyramus and Thisbe. Ovid tells the sad story in his Metamorphoses. The Babylonian youth Pyramus was to meet his beloved Thisbe at the white mulberry tree, which grew over the tomb of Ninus, founder of Nineveh, that famous biblical town Jonah was sent to convert. In our story, Thisbe arrived first at the rendezvous, but instead of her young man, a lion appeared, and so Thisbe, petrified, fled. But she left her veil, and the lion besmeared it with blood. So when Pyramus arrived, he thought she'd been devoured, and so killed himself in desperation. Thisbe then returned, and seeing her lover dead, stabbed herself too. As we do today, Shakespeare saw the funny side and turned it into a comic scene of very tragical mirth, acted by his rustics in A Midsummer Night's Dream. In the language of flowers, black mulberry means I shall not survive you, while white mulberry signifies wisdom. Perhaps because Pliny considered it the wisest of trees. Why? Because though it was the last to flower, its fruit was the first to open. And an old Gloucestershire proverb runs, after the mulberry tree has shown green leaf, there will be no more frost. And indeed, in a Gloucestershire garden, there's a 20-year-old mulberry tree. And you can read in the guidebook that the owner of the garden uses the tree as a weather guide and quotes John Evelyn, 17th-century sage and horticulturist, who advises us not to stand our tender plants outside until the mulberry comes into flower. And so there you are. Thankfully, unlike the mustard seed, there's been no horrific use of mulberry in warfare. But strange to say, the word was used in the Second World War as a code name for the prefabricated ports that were towed across to the Normandy coast to assist the supply of Allied armies after the Normandy landings on D-Day 1944. The name was chosen simply because it was the next in rotation on the British Admiralty's list of names available for warships. In the second part of today's Gospel, our Lord reminds us that we are merely servants, and when we've done our duty, we must be satisfied with that and not expect thanks. But here again, he uses pastoral images. The servant who comes in from the fields has been ploughing or minding sheep, both well-known country occupations down the centuries to our own day. Both forceful images, and ones our Lord uses frequently. He himself is the good shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep. As for the plough, it has innumerable connotations. And as a modern writer puts it, even using today's modern machinery, ploughing remains the most evocative of the year's tasks on the farm. And to illustrate that, let's listen to a piece written nearly 100 years ago, when horses were still used to draw the plough. Here now is part of Edward Thomas's essay, Faunus.
How nobly the ploughman and the plough and three horses, two chestnuts and a white leader, glide over the broad swelling field in the early morning. Under the dewy dark green woodside they wheel, pause and go out into the strong light again. And they seem one and glorious, as if the all-breeding earth had just sent them up out of her womb. Richard the ploughman is worthy of his plough and team. He moves heavily with long strides over the baked yellow field, swaying with the violent motion of the plough as it cuts the stubborn and knotty soil, and yet seeming to sway out of joy and not necessity. He is a straight, small-featured, thin-lipped man, red-haired with blue eyes of a fierce loneliness, almost fanatical. Hour after hour he crosses and recrosses the field, up to the ridge where he can see miles of hill and wood, down to the woodside where the rabbits hardly trouble to hide as he appears, or to the thick hedge with marigolds below, and nearly all day the song of nightingales. The furrow is always straight. He could plough it, so is sleep, and sometimes perhaps he does. To the ordinary man, such a task would seem fatal. The immense monotony of similar furrows and the same view repeated exactly every quarter of an hour. But Richard is no ordinary man. He goes about, even in the 4 hours' darkness of the winter mornings, with always a song amidst the sleet or the silent frost. And to see him and his team, all dark and large and heroic against the sky, ploughing in the winter or the summer morning, or to see him grooming the radiant horses in their dim stable on a calm, delaying evening, is to see one who is in league with sun and wind and rain, to make odours fume richly from the ancient altar, to keep the earth going in beauty and fruitfulness for still more years.
Well, that, although written in prose, is the poetic vision of the style of ploughing that is no more. And so, from the myriad paths down which we've wandered, the many themes thrown up by two simple images, let's return to that of faith and listen to the experience of a 19th-century poet who, standing at his window overlooking the Straits of Dover, reflects on the faith once present in the world and grieves that it seems to have ebbed away like the tide. Here now is Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach.
The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the ebb meets the moon-blanched sand, listen, you can hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves suck back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once, too, at the fall, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world. Love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here, as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night.
And let's conclude with this more positive, if perhaps more simplistic, 20th century hymn to faith.
Faith. I cannot imagine what I would be like without it, what my life would be like without it. It's the reason for my life, for my living. It's the reason for the joy I feel, in spite of many reasons for being depressed, discouraged, disappointed. Faith is the sun that comes out after every shower of rain. It's the breath of wind that lifts the fog of unreason. It's the sudden blooming of a flower in midwinter. Have you ever walked through a field of thorn bushes and looked up to see the sun shining on the distant sea? Or tramp down a dark lane and be surprised by the song of a bird? Or come round the corner of your house to find a rainbow arched across the sky and gasped at its unexpectedness and the brilliance of its colours? Faith is all these things and much more. It's the knowledge that we are loved, and its fruit is a joyous hope.
And you were listening there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, who's about to bring us the Vatican Week in review. Joan, we're recording on the 4th of October,
and it's
a very special day.
It is a very special day because Pope Francis is in the home of St. Francis. He's in Assisi, and my understanding is that this is his very first time ever in life in Assisi. So an amazing, amazing visit. He said when they were preparing the trip that he wanted to see as many spots as he could, and any of our listeners who have been to Assisi know that there's an incredible number of basilicas of church, of many, many spots associated with St. Francis, but also with St. Clair. So, and the numbers are very interesting. I was in Assisi last weekend to kind of, you know, how's the city preparing, building of the stage, things like that. And 140,000 requests came in for tickets. Now, people were only going to get tickets for specific places, one venue only. So the Basilica or St. Clair's or Santa Maria degli Angeli or St. Rufino. But I had a taxi driver tell me they had 100,000 people there after 9/11 for a march for peace. And he says, we didn't know where to put them. They were down below the town of Assisi, you know, in the fields. But an incredible number of people expected, and 1,200 members of the media have requested accreditation, which is more than for any of John Paul's six visits there. Huge number of media, huge number of volunteers. 50 parking lots have been arranged, extra trains for 10,000 pilgrims, 9 mega screens set up around the city, which I think is the only way that a lot of the pilgrims are going to be able to see the Pope. Because you know how the streets, the winding serpentine up and down roads of Assisi, you can be 100 feet from where the Pope's going to say Mass and not be able to see him, just the way buildings and everything are. So the best thing is to probably, if you're not in Assisi, certainly watch it all on TV. I mean, even for starters, the Pope's, I think it was his second talk of the day, he addressed the poor people that are being helped by Caritas. He was in the Vescovado, and it was an amazing talk because it was like totally off the cuff. You could hear his mind thinking, the slow way that he was forming his words and so forth. And unfortunately, we don't have the time to go into some of the expressions that he used, but I think people will be able to read those in their papers the next day. But no, it's a very historic day. The Bishop Sorrentino of that diocese where Assisi is referred to the historic nature of the trip. And as I say, when you look at it in numbers, the people attending, the extra 80,000 city maps have been prepared, 20,000 hats, 20,000 bottles of water for emergencies, 350 new road signs set up for people to indicate where various basilicas and churches are and so forth. And 1,200 people are taking care of all these things, giving the maps out, the water, et cetera. So, you know, if we only spoke about one event, one highlight of the week, it would be that. Obviously, there were a few others because we are living in the age of the surprise-a-day papacy of Pope Francis. So other highlights of the week, which, again, we can only do in a superficial manner. One, of course, we cannot not mention the announcement that on Divine Mercy Sunday 2014, which is April 27th.
The Sunday after Easter each year.
The Sunday after Easter that Popes John Paul II, Blesseds John Paul II and John the 23rd will be canonized. And, of course, Divine Mercy Sunday is a day that the Sunday after Easter, John Paul declared that Divine Mercy Sunday, and he died on the vigil of Divine Mercy Sunday in 2005. So very meaningful there. We'll be talking a lot more about both of these men, obviously, in coming months. Interestingly enough, April 27th, Divine Mercy Sunday, also marks the 75th birthday of Cardinal Żywiec, who was John Paul's secretary and close friend for 40 years, and succeeded him as the Archbishop of Krakow in Poland. And that, as if that wasn't big enough and news enough to occupy newspapers for a week, on Tuesday we had the announcement that a chirograph, which is supposedly a handwritten document nobody writes by hand anymore,
but signed by him.
It's a document signed by the Pope, and so hand, you know, signed by hand, but a chirograph normally regards something regarding the Roman Curia. That's how it's different from an encyclical, an apostolic constitution. So with this chirograph, what the Pope did was formalize this body of cardinals, now to be called the Council of Cardinals. We know he has asked 8 cardinals to help advise him in the running of the church, the running of the Roman Curia. Those cardinals held meetings 3 days this week in Rome. This was the first series. They've talked with the Pope before their October meetings. They talked with each other. Each of the cardinals from a vast geographical area, each of the cardinals also spoke to cardinals and bishops in their own geographical area or country for input. The chirograph, again, now formalizes this. So, like, from now on, there will always be a council of cardinals. No set date was given for the next meeting. It was kind of like, well, maybe next spring. And frankly, it would make a lot of sense to have it in April, wouldn't it, around the time of the canonizations, because everybody's going to be in Rome anyway for that. So an important document. And also this week, it was announced that another document, which has been in vigor for 35 years, the Pastor Bonus, the Apostolic Constitution on the Roman Curia, that's going to be like torn up and rewritten. the cardinals have decided it isn't just a question of retouching a few paragraphs or let's do this about councils or congregations. They are rewriting, which is a very historic thing in itself. And that was John Paul's constitution, Pastor Bonus, which means good shepherd. But just some of the, to briefly, in a couple of words, look at, other than that, at what the Pope and the cardinals have discussed. They've looked at the role of the laity within the Roman Curia. That's what all the cardinals seem to have gotten as input from their priest and their bishops. The cardinals have looked at, and again, with the Pope, except for the Wednesday audience, when he was not present at that morning meeting, because the cardinals met every morning and afternoon. The Council of Cardinals also looked at the relation of Vatican offices, called dicasteries, with the Pope and with each other. It was suggested but not amplified something about the role of a curial moderator. What does that even mean? I can't tell you today because we don't know. But more of that will probably come up. And Father Lombardi, who gave briefings to all of us on these meetings, said that another very important theme was the nature and the functions of the Secretariat of State, which should really be, quote, the Secretariat of the Pope. The word state should not give rise to any doubt. And he said, this body serves this is Father speaking, this body serves the Pope in the governance of the Universal Church. And so the meeting of the Council of Cardinals is very useful right now in view of the directions the Pope will give to the new Secretary of State, who we must say will assume his role on October 15th, Pietro Parolin. And then another important issue discussed was a possible reorganization of the administration of temporal goods. Now, there is the umbrella term APSA, APSA, refers to the administration of the patrimony of the Apostolic See. And by patrimony, among other things, it means personnel of the Holy See, and it also means the goods, the buildings that they own, churches they run, so forth, churches that they belong to, the Catholic Church, and so forth. So there might be a reorganization of APSA, though that was not the name. They said just the administration of the temporal goods. But now the cardinals didn't go too much into that because they said they didn't explore it in depth because they're awaiting the reports of the referring commissions on this matter, who will communicate the results of their work to the council. So historically, a very, very important week, the announcement of the canonizations, the formalization of the Council of Cardinals, the work they're going to do, which it's like, oh my gosh, what is the Roman Curia going to be a year from now? You and I will be talking about it, so that'll be good. And then Pope Francis's trip to the home of St. Francis.
And he's taken his council with him.
And yes, he has. He's taken the eight cardinals. What a lovely, lovely gesture. So I'm sure they all know Assisi even better than the Holy Father. However, it's a remarkable day for the town of Assisi. He's not the first pope to go there, but he is the first pope named Francis. So a very special day for all the Assisians, as I learned how they are called.
Thank you very much, Joan.
It was a good week here.
And our thanks there go to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. She'll be back again at this same time next week, so be sure to join her then. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at this same time next weekend. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.